Hey, Charlotte Talks fans. Do you have 5 minutes to spare? If you do, then we'd love for you to take our Charlotte Talks listener survey. Super quick, super important for us, and you can find it right now on WFAE.org. We appreciate the feedback. Thanks.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. CMS puts out a big budget request, $1.5 billion. That includes money for teacher pay raises and for hardening schools with things like bulletproof doors. CMS also comes out on top of the nation's report card for reading and math scores. Mayor Vial Iles believes $50 million is the right amount, or she did when she was on this program. I'm told it's grown to ask for a November bond to replenish the city's affordable housing trust fund. And we hear about Bank of America's decision eliminating funding for gun manufacturers who make military-style weapons for civilian use, South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham's exchange with Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg, and what Governor Roy Cooper has to say about I-77 tolls. Our roundtable of reporters has details on those and other stories this hour on the Local News Roundup. David Borax is here from WFAE.
Morning, Mike.
Morning. And Doss Helms joins us from the Charlotte Observer.
Good morning.
Good morning. Kirsten Garris returns from Spectrum News, where she is a government reporter, among other things. Thank you for being here.
Good morning.
And Eric Spanberg, just a seat away from me, is senior staff writer for the Charlotte Business Journal. Welcome to you.
It's an honor to be a seat away from you, Mike.
I know
you.
I know it is. We're all on the radio, but if that isn't enough for you, you can watch us on Facebook Live. This morning we'll all wave at you. This week, CMS Superintendent Clayton Wilcox unveiled his budget. It comes in at $1.5 billion, including an additional $40 million from the county. How does that compare, Ann, to previous budget requests?
It's a bit bigger, and the way this works, for anybody who's not familiar with school funding, is that the school district does not have taxing authority, so they're basically getting money mostly from the state, and a lot of that is outside of their control. So that's sort of predicting what the state is going to give based on enrollment and their programs. The county chunk is the chunk that local people get most engaged with, and this is a pretty big request. He's asking for $468.5 million. And that's up almost $40 million. That's big. It's not the biggest increase that CMS has ever asked for, and it's not quite as big as Wake County's request, which came in the day before. They're actually seeking a $60 million increase from their county commissioners. So it's interesting because this is the first budget pitch from Clayton Wilcox, who took office in July. He was kind of shadowing Ann Clark when they did this time last year.
Will that soften the blow because they want to cut a break to a new guy?
Well, that's hard to tell. It's never totally about the superintendent, but the superintendent is the person who makes the presentation. This will actually have to be approved by the school board before it goes to county commissioners. That generally goes pretty smoothly, and I think Dr. Wilcox got good reviews on this presentation that he did on Wednesday night. They've got a website, ourkidsneedus.org, and it is really a much more reader-friendly presentation. It makes it easier for people to give some feedback. But Dr. Wilcox is not sort of a polished communicator like Peter Gorman and Heath Morrison were. He doesn't have the longtime community contact that Ann Clark did. So it's going to be kind of interesting to see how this guy can or cannot rally the community to say this is something that's really needed.
And this is the first shot across the bow of a process that goes on for a while to get money to cover local teacher raises, in this case, bulletproof doors for the schools, and other measures to boost learning and safety. He said, and in the superintendent's words,
"This budget is not just a budget request. It is literally a call to action. It's a call to action around creating safe schools for all of our young children."
So how much of this budget is dedicated to hardening schools?
That's about Kirsten. $9 million.
Is that enough?
No, it's not. So to really upgrade all 176 CMS schools, it would probably cost, I think he said, excess of like $100 million. So there's no way.
So what does $9 million buy us?
We will find out. Basically, Wilcox says once the county approves the budget, he'll see how much money he has for security, and he will then pick which schools will get those upgrades.
But he is talking about bulletproof doors. He's talking about a window film that basically reinforces the window so that if you shoot at it, it doesn't just shatter and the person can't come in. It's going to take a lot. If that happens to be the window the person's trying to come through, it will slow them down, which is important. Security monitoring cameras, both on campuses and literally in classrooms, some technology that might make it a little easier for a teacher to alert people if there is a problem in the classroom, fences for some campuses. And again, he has said this is a tiny slice of what we'd need. This is not going to do what we need for 176 schools.
Following Sandy Hook, they asked for, and I think they got, $19 million to harden the schools. What did they spend that money on? And is there any of that money left?
No, I think they spent that, and that has been a lot of the door locks. Again, when you get to these campuses,
so they're
going
to have to take the door locks off and put them on the new doors?
They may have to, and they actually, there's also some staffing that's part of this, some new CMS police officers. There's actually funding in here requested for locksmiths and electronics technicians who would work with installing and monitoring these doors. But again, kind of what we saw, you know, they initially said, oh, all of our doors are locked, they're secured, and people on these, you know, these campuses that have multiple buildings with kids coming and going all day, adults coming and going, said, no, there's a lot of unlocked doors.
I want to mention one thing real quickly that I was mentioning to Ann before the show, which is I ran into Commissioner Jim Puckett yesterday, and I was just asking him sort of casually about the school budget, and he mentioned the security piece being the most important piece. And he said one of the things that he is thinking about recommending is that that be funded through existing bond money, that you could steer bond money. And he cited specifically West Charlotte High, which, as you know, was a very controversial part of the whole county commission backing the bonds that were approved by voters last year. So that could get interesting once this gets to the county commission.
Yeah, and I think the key point here, and you mentioned that they've got a website to help get the community to know more about this. There's really only a small group of people they need to sell this to, and that's the county commission. And this is a process. I think he's gotten good instruction from his predecessor about aiming high on this because they're not going to get everything that they ask for. And really, they just need to sell it to the county commission.
And he pretty much said that out of the gate. I don't know if he's a very good poker player because, you know, when we were interviewing him afterward, he was like, well, we aren't going to get all of this, but we're going to get some of it. And But that is going to be that challenge of which schools get what. Do you take one of the newer schools that's almost there and spend a small amount to really do the doors and windows so it's 100% there? Do you look at a West Charlotte that's scheduled for a $110 million complete revamp, but that's going to launch in 2022? Do you take that money and divvy it up elsewhere? You know, it's the priority setting is going to be a really big challenge.
But politically, it seems to me, this is something they can't say no to.
Well, this has always been a hotly contested issue whenever the budget comes up with county commissioners and school board. And I know I talked with Commissioner Pat Cotham yesterday, and she said, you know, she doesn't want this to be a knee-jerk reaction to a tragedy. She said tragedies are bad. Obviously, you know, we need to learn from them. But she was like, realistically, you can't make every school a prison, and you don't want that. You want schools to be welcoming. Her big piece was actually mental health. In this budget, there's about more than $4 million that would be set aside for student support services, so hiring more elementary school counselors, social workers, and psychologists. And Cotham made the point was, well, would these psychologists be available for teachers? Because teachers are going through a lot right now, too. She said, you think about it, if you have some students who are going through some tough times, whether they're homeless or dealing with a lot of issues with parents and whatnot, teachers might need someone to talk to. So she said those are the things she's looking at is mental health and where would that go? Who would it help?
Yeah, there's $4.4 million to hire 33 elementary school counselors, 17 school social workers, and 10 school psychologists. Will lawmakers agree with the need?
Yes, I think so. I think 5 years ago that would have been viewed as kind of fluff, but I think there has just been such a movement of people from all levels saying, you can't teach a kid math and reading if they're traumatized, if they're struggling with homelessness. You know, some of this has to do with the actual violence, whether that's self-harm. You know, suicide has been a big issue, whether that is the potential to harm your classmates. But really, I think there is a widespread consensus that these support staff are vitally needed and are part of the education.
You know, and correct me if I'm wrong, but this is replacing people whose jobs went away in recent years. I mean, we've been talking about adding these services, not just for violence, but also for suicide and those sort of things. And, you know, these are positions that the school system once had.
Well, not only that, I think it and you may have mentioned this in your story, Ann, it veers over into the whole discussion about economic mobility and workforce training, because obviously education is a huge part of that. So I'm not talking about the psychologist specifically, but I'm just talking about the additional funding. So I think that would also lend strength to the argument of the school system.
And that's something to remember is that the county commissioners don't have line item decisions. They don't go through and say, we'd like the bulletproof doors, but we don't care about this item. They decide on a total amount. And there's always that tension of, even if we agree in theory that you deserve every penny of this, if our growth is not enough to cover a $40 million increase, are we willing to raise taxes or cut other services? And that's a really hard sell.
This budget request is to the county?
Yes. Well, budget proposal, the $1.5 billion is state, federal, county, okay. Everything.
But are they asking the state for additional money?
You don't really ask the state. The state has all these allocations.
Are they informing the state that they need extra money?
The state is providing various things, including additional teachers, and this is worth mentioning, additional elementary school art, PE, and language teachers as part of this compromise that came out of the class size cap.
Raises also are coming from the state.
Yes, there are also.
The state doesn't specifically grant a CMS request.
There are also pay raises, teacher pay raises in this budget request. They already add 15% to 19%, I think, to teachers' state pay based on experience and credentials. And this new request would add an additional 7%, or an average of about $500 a teacher, for a total of $7 million in this budget. $500 per teacher. It's $1.98 per teacher workday.
Right. And
why bother?
Clayton Wilcox, well, I think he was trying to sell this as not extravagant,
but it's an interesting point.
Again, the local supplement, 15 to 19% is not bad. So there's a pretty decent local supplement already. The teachers will also be getting state pay raises. And again, that will depend on your years of experience and your credentials. Some people will get more than 7%. Some people will get less. So teachers overall will be seeing potentially, it's never going to feel like enough, but they're going to see potentially some pretty decent overall. You can always sort of break it down to per day, and that was sort of his attempt to say, this is not extravagant. We're not throwing $7 million at, you know, one school or one teacher. It breaks down, and people may say that. They may say this is not worth the effort.
So $1.5 billion budget request from Clayton Wilcox and the schools, and now City Council heard from citizens on Monday night about the need for affordable housing. A lot of people came out and talked about how they were being squeezed out of their own apartments because as development continues in the city, the price of existing apartments keeps going up, and it's eating into their, fixed income. The city funds affordable housing through something called the Housing Trust Fund, and every 2 years they go to the voters and ask for money in a form of a bond. The last several times it's been $15 million. The mayor was on this program, I think it was yesterday, and she said that she believes that we are facing a crisis. This time, $50 million is the right amount to ask for, and now is the time to do it.
Think about if you bought a house 10 years ago, that house is appreciated. If we don't do something today, what is going to be the cost 5 years from now? We have rapidly increasing costs in construction, land acquisition costs, all of those things are going on. So why not take the dollar and get more out of it today than 5 years from now?
But you just told me before we went on the air, Kirsten, that the $50 million that was right yesterday, moments after the show ended, evidently, it became $150 million.
Yes, not literally through the bond, so don't be worried. Don't worry, your bond is not going to be $150 million. But during a affordable housing kind of breakfast meeting she had yesterday with former Charlotte Mayor Anthony Fox, she talked about how the community needs to step up and really help fix this affordable housing crisis. They've said this in meetings before, that this is not just a city issue or a county issue. It is a community issue, and the community has to help out. And so she said she wants the bond that voters would approve to be $50 million, and then she challenged the private sector to donate $50 million and the faith-based community to donate $50 million, so $150 million, so 10 times what we've seen in the past. So that's pretty, you know, That's a big ask to ask the community to step up in that way, because it's literally saying put your money where your mouth is to fix this issue.
Eric, Eric wants to jump in here, but Eric hears the music. He hears music in his head.
I know what that
means. He knows that we're
coming. Can't answer this in 10 seconds.
That's right. So I'll let you have the first word, Eric Spanberg.
Thank you.
When we come back, it's the local news roundup on Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE. It's the local news roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, along with David Borax from WFAE News, Andos Helms from the Charlotte Observer, Kirsten Garris from Spectrum News, and Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Observer. Before the break, we were talking about the need for affordable housing. The mayor has asked for $50 million.
Isn't Charlotte Observer?
What did I say?
We'll take him.
You may be okay. Ann's coworker. That's fine.
Okay, well,
good. Can you make him my assistant?
Eric Spanbridge with the Business Journal. Okay, before the break, we were talking about affordable housing. The mayor has put forth a request for $50 million for a bond request in the fall. Now she's come forward and she said $50 million from the faith community would be nice, $50 million from the business community would be nice. And you wanted to chime in on that.
Well, right? I was just going to say that I think that the way Kirsten explained it is exactly, of course, she was there and I wasn't. So it's exactly right in the sense that this is very much on the minds of the business community, and I think that you will see buy-in from the corporate sector. I'm most curious about the faith community, which I think you'll have plenty of buy-in. It just sounds like a big number to me, so I don't know if you can get to $50 million. And, of course, you know, there's also a sort of a secondary debate about what kind of affordable housing to build. You know, is it for the people who have the very least amount of money, or is it so-called workforce housing, which is – I think typically defined by 80% of the median income. There's a big shift there, and the mayor has said that she is looking to help all people of all income ranges, but you do have to sort of pick and choose at some point.
And there is an argument on council or a disagreement on council about whether they should be building houses for people who make $56,000 a year or less, or people who are in abject poverty.
And that's where the biggest need is.
Exactly. I mean, that's where the need is. I mean, there's a new study that shows they need 24,000 rental units for low-income households. And that is that 30% and lower AMI or average median, I think, income. So, I mean, that's literally folks who are in poverty, who are making very little money and trying to support a whole family.
And that's about two-thirds of the total need. So the biggest need is at that lowest income level. And we've got to try and figure this out. This is kind of the policy now is following things that we've been talking about in Charlotte for years. I mean, if you remember the Economic Opportunity Task Force report a couple of years ago specifically recommended that $50 million number, which is where that's coming from. It also said we need participation from the private sector and from the faith community, which you mentioned. So, you know, we're talking now about implementing the things in that report. I mean, how long are we going to talk about it?
Well, and not only that, for some context, remember that City Council, after the riots and the protests, they accelerated their affordable housing 5,000 units from 5 years to 3 years. I mean, 5,000 units, and you just said, who just said 24,000?
Yeah, 24,000 for low income. And that's
low income. So, yeah. I mean, that gives you some sense of how far behind they are. The other thing that strikes me is this is, in a lot of ways, sort of being shamed into taking action, because when you combine the riots and the protests, and then you take the study that is invariably cited from 2014 that ranked Charlotte dead last in economic mobility, I think that's what's really galvanized both the political and corporate sectors in particular.
Just another factoid on the 5,000 goal from the City Council. As of late March, they were about 72% of the way towards that goal, so not even all the way to the 5,000. But the bigger goal, the actual need, is so much higher. Yeah,
so she's asked the city manager to study the impact of a $50 million bond package. We don't know what that impact is and what that will do to taxes.
Correct.
But she says that the public seems to be ahead of the lawmakers on this. Do you think she's right?
I think it's a conversation. It's a conversation that's happening in our community, and people want to find a way to help. I know in some of these recent affordable housing sessions they've had at City Council, we've heard from community groups that are finding ways to not just address giving someone a place to live, but why were they struggling to find a place to live? Why were they having a hard time? So they're trying to change habits. Some of these community groups, I think it's Away Home, was the program that's working with people who are either about to be evicted, just evicted, or recently homeless, to help them grow better financial habits so that they can eventually move on their own and live in market rate housing. So that's the goal, is you hear the community saying, how can we fix the issue that is plaguing folks with housing?
I do think there's broad public support, but when you start talking tax impact is when things get real.
What I was going to say.
I really want affordable housing. It's going to raise your taxes by X amount. I really want a different approach to affordable housing.
Similar to, I think you're going to bring this up later, Mike, the subject of police recruiting and police pay. Mm-hmm. Almost everyone is going to say, yes, policemen should make more. Yes, we should do more to recruit police. The question is, when we get to the tax hike, a possible tax hike, then do people still support?
Well, that's where I'm going next, because a few weeks ago we heard it was becoming very difficult for CMPD to retain and to attract new officers because of pay levels, and the Fraternal Order of Police back then asked for a 15% increase to base pay as well as a reduction in the number of steps needed to reach full pay. This week, Kerr Putney, the chief, told City Council he's struggling to fill 74 empty positions because of what CMPD pays. CMPD employs about 1,800 people. In what areas are these 174 vacancies? Do we know?
sworn officers. I know that much. That's how he's describing it.
We're down 174 police officers?
Sworn officers. And he recently brought in 34 lateral transfer officers, but that still wasn't his goal.
Is that down from former full capacity, or is that because it's for several years in a row now? He said we are under-policed and need more officers and never got the amount of money to fill the positions that he wanted. So is this... is this number subtracted out from what we already had, or is this a deficit of what he'd like to have?
I'm sure it's a combination of both. I can't quite answer that question, but he said that there has been, the environment has changed. I mean, we all saw what happened with the Keith Scott shooting here in Charlotte. There was this very much anti-police kind of sentiment in the community. People didn't trust the police. Mm-hmm. You know, people asking for more transparency. And the chief even mentioned that on Tuesday, that this is a tough environment to recruit people when there's a lot of negativity around the profession. And even over the years, there have been more people retiring either voluntarily or just retiring through attrition. But you see more people leaving the department for other reasons besides, you know, it's time to retire. They're leaving because of pay and benefits.
Putney says he's trying to dig himself out of a hole. The police department saw 20% decreases in people applying for jobs in 2016 and 17. And the city manager says he has money for the type of raises that were given last year, but not for what he called enhancements. What does all that mean in connection with the police? Are these enhancements, increasing police pay? We don't know, do we?
It's hard to say. I think it's okay. Where does the money come from? Because that FOP request of 15% raise, mm-hmm. that would cost taxpayers $22 million.
And don't they also have the health care mm-hmm. benefits they're talking
so
about?
So that's, I mean, you have to think about that. Where does that money come from?
So the problem, as you alluded to a second ago, Kirsten, is not just in the pay raises. It's the morale and the negative connectivity with police, not only here but around the country. And he brought this up, that it's become a deterrent around the country and also here in the shadow of the Keith Scott shooting.
If all we talk to our people about is accountability and transparency and lack of trust, people who want to become a part of that profession have second thoughts.
So what's he saying here, that calls for greater transparency and accountability are a deterrent to becoming a police officer?
Not necessarily, but it's tough when everyone is criticizing this profession, and from all angles. Like you said, it's not just Charlotte, it's not just North Carolina, the entire country. I mean, there has been a lot of discussion. Police have been thrown into the spotlight. I think they weren't prepared for that because a lot of these police shootings are now making it onto TV screens because of cell phones and Facebook Live videos. So I think there's a bigger discussion nationwide about police officers and transparency. So I'm sure it is making it tough to recruit when, you know, the stories about the everyday cop who helps the kid cross the street or who buys the sneakers for the kid who has no shoes, we don't see those stories. And that's why people become cops. They want to make a difference in their community.
And
the overall economy is a factor, too. Sort of the better the economy is, the more other jobs are out there, the harder it becomes to recruit, whether it's police or teachers or anything that is a high-demand, relatively low-paying job.
So what would this do to the budget? If the police got what they wanted, what would this do to the budget? Do we know? And has the city manager made any commitment to try to find the money? Because he talked about money for the raises he gave last year, but not enhancements.
Yeah, no one has officially said how this would play into the budget because all the budget workshop they have, it's really more discussion. It's like, okay, let's get a sense of the council. What's really important? What could be maybe decreased? What needs to be increased? And it's very clear that for some, especially the Republicans, I know Ed Driggs and even Tariq Bakari have both said vocally, we need to do something for police officers in some way, shape, or form. So we'll find out May 7th.
The question is whether we're willing to do a tax increase for something like this. There are lots of requests on the table that all would require a little bit more, and you add all those up. You know, blame the tax increase on any one of those things that you want to. But the question is, do we want to do that?
Not only that, but the majority of council backed away from that idea. I think it was Councilman Driggs who won sort of the special budget session to discuss police pay in depth. Mm-hmm. And the rest of the council said, let's defer to the city manager.
Because also on Monday, when you were there, Kirsten, covering the council meeting, unionized city workers expressed a desire for not only for a pay raise, but to do something about unaffordable health care costs.
That's right. So that's the
thing. Who are these unionized city workers? Who are they?
It's from Union. It's UE Local 150. It's a very complicated name, so that's why I'm making sure I get it right. But it's basically, it was Charlotte Water, basically any city employee. But I know I specifically talked with a CATS employee, the Charlotte Area Transit System. Some of their blue light folks are like, hey, we need more people to maintain these trains, so we want a pay raise too. And they're also asking for 15%. So it's like you have a lot of people who are asking for pay raises, and they're giving, you know, a laundry list of reasons why. So it'll be interesting to see how the city handles this because you need all these folks. You need police officers. You need blue light workers. You need city water. So it'll be interesting to see where this discussion goes.
there's a lot of stuff coming together all at once here, people asking for pay raises. How much of that is pent-up frustration from the economic downturn of, what, 10 years ago now?
Yeah, well, I think that's a big part of it. I think the other thing is, Ann made a really good point, not only is it harder to recruit, it's harder to keep people yeah. in relatively low-paying jobs when the economy is strong. And we are just now really this year starting to see salaries move in a number of industries. And so I think that's also playing a role.
One other interesting point here. I mean, we're in the budget season. That means that department heads are presenting their requests to the city and the county and the school board. It seems to me that many of these employees are getting a little more savvy about that process and getting a jump on it early on, where they are helping to drive those budget requests during this part of the process instead of, oh, look, we didn't get a raise, or we didn't get a very big raise again. I think it's an evolution of employees' awareness about this.
And I think it's also kind of a maturing of becoming a larger city, that the employees are becoming more aggressive. That just wasn't sort of the Charlotte way.
Yeah.
I mean, so to speak. You've been here a long time, Mike. That's a little different, I think.
And I think pictures speak louder than words. I mean, we're seeing people show up in dozens, by the dozens, to these meetings. They might not be talking, but, you know, when the FOP asked for that 15% raise, there were hundreds of police officers filling up the chambers. And when one person was speaking, all of them are standing up. Yeah. That sends a message.
And they got on TV early in the process here.
Yeah, it was like February. So, yeah.
You're giving me all my segues today, Kirsten. Thank you very much.
There we go.
If a picture's worth 1,000 words, they've released some pictures this week. In January, there was a shootout in the parking lot at CMPD headquarters uptown. Officers were talking to each other when 23-year-old Jonathan Bennett allegedly drove up and began shooting. One officer was wounded. Officers returned fire. They killed Bennett. CMPD Chief Putney later called this an ambush. And the DA, Spencer Merriweather, ruled that the two CMPD officers and two probation officers who fired their guns acted lawfully in doing so because they were in imminent danger. This week, they released the body cam footage from this incident. What did it show?
It showed the lead up. You saw officers just talking, and then you heard, you know, the gunshots. And it's interesting, with anything, we're now getting more and more video. So we had three camera video released. We had three different angles of what happened. So in one video, you see one officer kind of going straight towards where Jonathan Bennett is, and you hear him say, like, I'm on the gun, I got it. Another one, you can see Officer Casey Hsu. She's the one who was hit in the leg. You see her kind of flinch a little bit, and you're like, oh, that probably is when she was hit in the leg. And another one, I think you hear, again, some more gunshots. But we're getting a closer look. It is graphic. I know we only showed a portion of it because it's a lot to take in. But it says a lot to have police departments releasing this stuff. So we get a clearer picture of what happened.
Can I ask a question about that? This really irritates me. So I'm going to get my irritation soapbox here for a second. Why do we have to be protected from what you've seen? You've seen the footage. The public wants to see this footage. Why do we have to be protected? Because it might be graphic. Why can't you just say, we want to warn you that this might be graphic and might disturb you? You may want to turn your head away for a few seconds.
Well, we do a little bit of both. On TV, we only air a portion of it. But then online, we say, look, the video is graphic, but here's the link.
Okay.
Go forth if you want to watch it. So but we do a little both.
But it confirmed the DA's decision.
Yes, I think so. Because okay. I think you saw they were just talking, and then all of a sudden chaos kind of ensued, and one of our photographers was there, and he said the same thing, like, we were just minding our business, and all of a sudden, you hear pop, 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 and thankfully, no one else was hurt, but that's a situation where, I mean, I remember actually think I was on the show after that happened, and a lot of us were in a state of shock, because we consider CMPD headquarters a safe place for reporters and whatnot. Like, if we can't really go back to a crime scene, we go there. So that had us, you know, a little bit shaken up as well, because that's a place we consider to be safe.
So let me reach into my bag and bring out some more school numbers, Ann, because CMS
from soapbox to the bag.
That's right. So CMS, CMS got some good news and some bad news on a national exam. CMS ranks number one in the nation on national 8th grade math exam. Am I getting this right?
Yes.
They're outperforming most other large school districts, but the test showed that 41% of CMS students rated as proficient. If only 41% of students are proficient, and that's the best in the nation, what are we doing in public schools?
Well, I think that's really the discussion there. And these exams, it's the National Assessment of Educational Progress, and the Department of Education created them for some kind of uniform accountability, because state tests, there was a while, you may recall, when North Carolina had really, really high proficiency rates on our state exams. And then you'd look at this and you'd be like, maybe we set the bar a little too low. So there just has not been a lot of progress anywhere over the past decade. You always get your little upticks and downs, but it's been fairly flat. And the racial gaps are just, you know, to me, the definition of one of those numbers that mixed feelings, they outperformed every other district for black students. And, you know, how do you, and this is again on eighth grade math, this is a key, you know, measure. Math is a gateway into higher ed, higher careers. Yay, number one in the nation, and that proficiency level was 25%.
Yes.
For CMS black students.
National average is 13%, North Carolina's 14%. What are we to take from this?
Boy, that's the big challenge, and we've talked about this on pretty much every measure, that these racial gaps remain, and income is also a factor. Whatever, and it does tell you that that CMS's problems are not unique. In fact, that as much as we may be frustrated by CMS's progress, it's actually doing a little better than most other districts. But
and
wow,
you point out in your article about this that some say that we do well because as compared to places like Chicago or Detroit or New York, we have more diversity, which is to say that we have more white kids in our public schools and that our white kids outperform white children in other systems as well.
And those numbers were really, you know, those you can actually feel good about. 70% of the CMS white students earned a proficient score on eighth grade math, and that's compared with 43% national average, 47% North Carolina, 49% for the urban district. So when you start getting to 70% proficiency, you feel pretty good, but yeah. You also ask, why the white students and why not the black and Hispanic students?
The bad news, oh, there's more bad news here, and that's that the tests are for 8th and 4th grade students in reading and math, and there was a dip in 4th grade math scores. Does that mean in 4 years, 8th grade math scores will dip?
That is a great question and one that I'm not sure I can answer, but it's okay. Particularly frustrating because locally and statewide, there's been such a push to get early reading improvement and a lot of investment. The state of North Carolina has spent more than $150 million on this Read to Achieve program. There are summer camps. There are, you know, barriers that you can't be advanced without hitting this reading level. There are digital devices being sent into schools. And the dip this year was actually not statistically significant. So I wouldn't get overly worked up about that dip. But on the other hand, what you want to see is progress, progress, progress every 2 years, and we're not seeing that.
Okay. We may come back and talk a little bit more about that. I'm not sure. We'll certainly talk about the Panthers when we come back. Bank of America's decision not to spend any more money or lend any more money to gun manufacturers making military-style weapons for civilian use, among other things. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks and the local news roundup on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Eric Spanberg, I believe, at last report, is with the Business Journal. He's with us. Ann Doss Helms, education reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Kristen Garris, government reporter for Spectrum News. And our own David Borax from WFAE News. A couple of final questions about this national report card that CMS did well on, except when you look dig a little deeper, it's kind of woeful, not just here, everywhere. CMS fourth graders outperform most other districts with 40% of students displaying reading proficiency. Eighth graders displayed 30% proficiency. And yet kids are graduating and going to high school.
Yeah, and again, bear in mind, this doesn't mean they can't read. You're looking for some fairly...
Does it mean that?
Well, to be labeled proficient, you have to demonstrate mastery of fairly complex material. So again, at eighth grade, you're not just talking about can you read a text, but can you analyze it? Do you understand the content? But that's pretty important. Again, that is, if you're going to go on to any kind of...
Reading is fundamental. Have you heard that?
I've heard that. So you ought to maybe copyright
campaign,
that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we spent, as you alluded to, $150 million over the last several years to boost reading. And I have to ask, was that money well spent? Is it having an impact? What would these scores be had we not spent $150 million?
That's a great question, and it's one that just keeps popping up in education, that you get these really sincere, well-intentioned, bold efforts to make changes. Project Lift is one of those. Read to Achieve is one of those. And politically, if it's the other guys that did it, you know, you can kind of say, ooh, look, you wasted the money. I think there will be questions. Mark Johnson, the superintendent, who was not in office when Read to Achieve was launched, said, we really commend our teachers, we commend the people who have been trying so hard to move this needle, but we're going to have to look at it, which is a pretty vague answer, but of course you ask the question.
Okay, let's move on to I'm not sure this is brighter news or not. That's the Panthers sale.
Another one where the numbers don't add up.
That's right.
so you mean we can't buy the Panthers?
Several. We put our jar.
The journalism pool is not working.
What's the thing if we used to take do with this money in the jar?
A certain bill.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. I'll take that money and buy the Panthers.
Combined, we could buy a helmet.
Several potential prospects to buy the Jerry Richardson's Carolina Panthers have been to town in recent weeks. The selecting bid should be, or the winning bid should be selected in the next couple of weeks. What do we know about where we stand? They're from people who've dropped out, evidently, right?
Yeah, what's interesting, Mike, is that essentially everyone's at the poker table, and they're all bluffing is what it boils down to. There was a report this week in the New York Times that it was down to two, and the gentleman who had been reported to be out then called the Charlotte Observer and said, I really like the people in Charlotte. So
that's Tepper.
Yeah, David Tepper, who is a hedge fund billionaire.
Minority owner of the Steelers.
Minority owner of the Steelers. So he would be an instant yes if he is willing to pay the price. That's the speculation, is that he is not willing to go as high as Ben Navarro, who is a Charleston-based financial services and credit card mogul, I guess, for lack of a better term. So there's also a gentleman named Alan Kestenbaum, who is involved in the minerals and steel industries. So those are your main players.
And Felix Sabatis, who said he would drop out when the money became ridiculous or not profitable.
And we're there.
He's dropped out. Yeah. It's $2.5 billion. What is driving up the price?
Well, I don't know that the price is actually going up, because Jerry Richardson at one point was told by his bankers, according to ESPN, that he would probably get as much as $3 billion for the team. And now you're looking more at a price range of $2.3 to $2.5, maybe $2.6 billion. Still not chump change, but it's not going to go quite as high as maybe Jerry Richardson thought. But
that could be the auctioneer setting a high price to start out with.
Well, true. But what's going on here is there are only 32 of these. They don't come up for sale much.
Right.
One thing to watch, though, as we get to the final price, remember, there are probably three or four more teams that are going to come on the market relatively soon, and that could drive the price down. We'll see.
So at this point, it looks fairly certain that the owner, the new owner, will be from out of town.
Yes.
Okay. Fans evidently don't care much for the Carolina Panthers' new draft cap. I don't want to spend any time on this, but
guilty.
They've panned this hat, which says on the front, two states, one team, and they say it should say keep pounding. And one person on their website, I guess, responded, did they use a glue gun to put the letters on the cap?
It does look like it maybe was made by a team at, is it Michael's? Is that the craft store? I think, yeah. Maybe.
Is there a problem with the slogan, two states, one team?
They've used that slogan before, but I think clearly the fans have spoken. They prefer keep pounding, so now we've solved that controversy.
All right. Bank of America announced this week that they will no longer lend money to gun manufacturers that make military-inspired firearms for civilian use. These would be these weapons that have been used in these school shootings. Was the decision made strictly internally or due to outside pressure? You know,
remember back after the Parkland shooting, Bank of America was among the companies that said that they would be taking a look at this. They weren't ready to go all the way there yet. You know, they really did need to talk to their own clients about this and assess what it means for them. You know, I think this is a case where Bank of America, being one of the largest companies in the U.S., has an opportunity to throw its weight around a little bit. The implications of this from a business perspective, I'm sure that the loans that they already have are going to stay there. So the money that Bank of America is making on that will continue to come in. Will they make any more? Probably not, or not in the same way that they've done in the past. And I think it's just a case where it's part of Bank of America's branding. Let's just call it that.
Well, let me back up. I think this is almost, maybe not, it's not entirely, but there is a lot of public sentiment involved in this. And look, companies respond to what customers and people are saying.
Mm-hmm.
That's the reason that Citigroup started this. They were the first one to stop lending money and make requirements in terms of 21 years or older, or not selling bump stocks, things like that. We've seen Walmart. We've seen Dick's Sporting Goods. What's interesting is we've not yet seen action from Wells Fargo. Their CEO said that they are talking to their clients. They are, according to Bloomberg, the largest financier of gun makers and also the bank of record for the NRA. So it'll be interesting to see what they do.
I wasn't going to talk about this, but I guess we can. Mick Mulvaney, who is in charge of this, what's it called, the organization?
The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau.
The first fine he's levied is a $1 billion fine against Wells Fargo.
They haven't done it yet. They've talked about doing it. I don't believe the fines have been levied. But yes, they've talked about a big number. And you remember President Trump, I don't think this was his loan tweet. He's had a few more. But he did have one about, I think it was in December, about how while regulations will be loosened on companies, those who are caught will be punished. And I believe he mentioned Wells Fargo by name. So for whatever, not for whatever reason, Wells Fargo is very much in the crosshairs of the CFPB.
Meanwhile, Bank of America and Harvard University are joining forces. They're leading an effort to examine the risks and rewards of artificial intelligence. They have announced the formation of the Council on the Responsible Use of Artificial Intelligence. Why this study now? Are we on the brink of something we need to know about here?
This is a topic that's very much in the news. This effort from Bank of America's side is being led by Kathy Bessent, one of their executives. If you have been paying attention to the Facebook story lately, you know that what's going on in the background of all these problems is using artificial intelligence to help track things. Facebook itself uses artificial intelligence internally to try and help get a handle on some of this. We heard some of the testimony this week about that. Companies like Bank of America are using this technology to try and figure out how it's a consumer company, how to better reach consumers from a marketing standpoint and also to better predict their behavior so they can serve them better. And so I think this is another case where a large company is at the forefront of something that's happening and they want to try and get a handle on it. Will they make any changes due to this? I think what they're saying is we think there's probably a line beyond which we don't want to go, and we're willing to get involved in a study of that.
They also might make more money.
Okay. Mark Zuckerberg went out and bought a suit and tie this week and appeared before a joint hearing of the Senate Judiciary and Commerce Committees, followed by a session with a House committee the next day. This is because of the revelation, of course, that the privacy of Facebook users seems lax, and because as many as 87 million of those users' private information was used by a company called Cambridge Analytica, which worked for the Trump campaign. He was there on testifying for hours. They peppered him with questions. South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham, his line of questioning has gotten a lot of attention. He was trying to get Zuckerberg to admit Facebook is a monopoly. He asked Zuckerberg who Facebook's biggest competitor was. Zuckerberg named Google, Apple, Amazon, and Microsoft. Senator Graham asked if they provide the same service. Zuckerberg replied, in different ways, in different parts, yes.
Car companies face a lot of competition. If they make a defective car, it gets out in the world, people stop buying that car, they buy another one. Is it an alternative to Facebook in the private sector?
Yes, Senator. The average American uses 8 different apps.
Is Twitter the same as what you do?
It overlaps with a portion of what we do.
You don't think you have a monopoly?
It certainly doesn't feel like that to me.
What do we tell our constituents, given what's happened here, why we should let you self-regulate?
Well, Senator, my position is not that there should be no regulation. Okay. I think the internet is increasingly
important. Do you embrace
important.
Regulation?
I think the real question, as the internet becomes more important in people's lives, is what is the right regulation, not whether there should
be
or not.
But you as a company welcome regulation?
I think if it's the right regulation, then yes.
Someone wrote that watching these hearings was like a teenager explaining to their parents how a cell phone works. Did he do a good job, Mark Zuckerberg? Because he doesn't like to be in public at all.
Oh, he'd prefer to speak online, wouldn't he? Yeah. The consensus seemed to be that he came out of this fairly unscathed, and that all things considered, there's a shout out to NPR.
Thank you.
That all things considered, it went pretty well for Facebook. But of course, the problem, or the what should concern him, is this is not the end. This is just the beginning. Because I do think, again, as we were talking about guns and banks, the overwhelming public sentiment is to do something to rein some of this in. And I don't think that this is going to be dropped.
And I do think in the technology world, the whole monopoly question is different. It's not directly comparable to the auto market, where you can just buy different versions of a car. That right now, Facebook does have something that's pretty darn close to a monopoly. And what will undermine that is not somebody that's doing the exact same Facebook thing, but somebody that does something completely different that distracts us. I mean, we can all think of numerous, we were talking about BlackBerries coming in. That just seemed to be the thing that everyone had to have until it was not. Or, all of these AOL, whatever it is, something that was really huge until somebody did something better.
It was funny. You know, you play that clip and he's pushing him, Senator Graham is pushing him. But then later, the question, would you work with us in terms of what regulations you think are necessary in your industry? Almost like, you know, it'd be a privilege for us as the federal government to have a chance to, that's not how other things are regulated. So you're right. There is a little bit of a clumsy grasp of what to do about this.
Yeah, would you work with us on that? And by the way, I have this little problem with my computer.
Yeah, exactly. Yell me with my bookmarks. Yeah.
He in a moment of drama, and these now that these things are on television, and I would love to go back like 100 years and see if this kind of drama went on when there weren't cameras
right
there. But Lindsey Graham lifted up this phone book of regulations. I mean, it was a phone book sized document, and it was the terms of service that you agree to when you first sign up for Facebook. And he said, "Do you think that that people understand what's in this?" And Zuckerberg said, "I don't think the average person likely reads the whole document."
Really?
Like, any of the documents.
Any of the documents.
How about none of it?
Except.
Except, or can I please add now? But I think one thing we'll be telling, though, is will people leave Facebook? I think for now it's tough to say. But, I mean, stuff on my Facebook, people are like, oh, I'm hearing people going to MySpace. But it's like, I don't know when that was a thing.
Into the time machine.
Speaking of technology.
Exactly. Let's go to the Wayback Machine. Yeah. But I think that's going to be a time telling. If people, I don't know how many millions of people are on Facebook, but if all millions of them jump off, then Zuckerberg might have an issue. But
it's
for now.
Like all these people that go on Facebook to announce that they're stepping off of social media. It's like,
All right, you spoke to Governor Roy Cooper in person this week, Eric, not on Facebook, not on Twitter, and you talked about several hot-button issues, among them the I-77 toll lanes and the contract now under review by the State Transportation Department. What exactly did you ask? What did he say?
So this was not this week, but maybe a week or two ago, just so I'm completely honest with when I was there. But I was asking about I-77, and we've talked about this a zillion times on this show, and the toll lane is going to be finished by the end of this year. So the governor had had his transportation secretary hire this consultant to study what could be done with the contract. We know there are several options, but they look expensive. And what the governor told me is that clearly something needs to be done. We're not sure exactly what needs to be done, and we don't know how to pay for it, but we are going to make a decision by the end of the year. So that's what we know.
He also sounded very much like Donald Trump when he said, we know the contract was not a good one. Is this simply a Democratic point of view versus the previous governor's Republican point of view?
No, I wouldn't say that, because there are plenty of Republicans around the Lake Norman area who have agreed that this is not a good contract. So they're,
and who voted for Cooper, for that matter.
Right. So, yeah, I think there is some bipartisan dissatisfaction with the contract.
So, David, Duke Energy wants to reprocess coal ash stored at the Buck plant in Salisbury and turn it into concrete and other construction materials. They're waiting through a 30-day public comment period to be through with all this. Is this something that will likely be approved?
Oh, yeah, they'll definitely approve this. This is a process that's been in place for a while. It's actually required under state law that Duke do reprocessing facilities at three of its plants around the state. It's not going to be a large amount. It'll be about 900,000 tons per year, which is just a drop in the bucket from the 100 million plus that they have around the state. But it will be something that actually critics of Duke Energy and environmentalists have been asking for. And basically what they'll do is they'll put this stuff into this processor. They'll reburn it to get the last bit of carbon out of it so that it can be used in concrete and other construction type of uses. And so I do think we're going to see this. One interesting thing is that at the hearing last week, there was a lot of critics that came out to oppose this. And they looked at everything from possible air emissions from these incinerators to other problems with this. Duke Energy is sort of complaining about that. You know, where were you guys? You guys wanted this, and now people are coming out and telling us they don't want it. How can we do something right? I do think this is going to be approved, though.
Yeah, because if you leave it where it is in these pits, it's likely to contaminate the groundwater and perhaps lakes and streams and rivers. And if you don't turn it, and everybody seems to want to turn it into some kind of usable material that doesn't contaminate the atmosphere, but to get there, you have to do something.
This is just addressing another concern, which is that we import to North Carolina coal ash from other places and use it in concrete. Why shouldn't we be doing it here?
Okay, you get the last word. And it's about the environment. Our environmental reporter, WFAE David Borax, Kirsten Garris with Spectrum News, Charlotte Andos Helms from the Charlotte Observer. I'm checking again. Yes, Eric Spanberg with the Charlotte Business Journal. Thank you all for the hour.